Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognized specialist in small animal surgery, Alan Danielski. Thank you, Alan. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, hi everybody. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about elbow dysplasia, and ideally at the end of this seminar, I would like you to be able to know how to perform a simple orthopedic examination in order to be able to localize which joint is the painful one, and then once you have localized the pain, in our case the pain would be localized hopefully to the elbow joint, then at that point I would like you to know what the best imaging techniques are to confirm that the problem is localized to the elbow joint, and then at that point I will tell you all about surgical and conservative techniques that are available at the moment, because it's really important that you know which techniques that are available at the moment, so then you can help also like the owner in taking the best decision to treat in order to be able to treat their dogs. Let's get started. So first of all, history, clinical history. So usually these owners are owners that come to see you because they're going to tell you that the dog is lame, the dog is stiff. Sometimes it's stiff only or painful or lame only after playing for a while in the park or after playing roughly with other dogs. And most of the time the lameness is actually visible only after lying down for a while. So a lot of them, they will tell you, my dog, we went to the park yesterday, everything was fine, the dog went to bed, in the morning woke up, it was incredibly stiff, incredibly painful for a few steps, for a few minutes, and then boom, the lameness disappeared and the dog was back to normal. Other owners, they will tell you, yes, after resting the dog is much, much better, but then as soon as I start exercising the dog again, the dog goes lame. Goes lame again. Anti-inflammatories sometimes do help, sometimes they don't help. It entirely depends by how bad the process, how bad like the pathology, the disease is inside the elbow. So at that point, after collecting a thorough history, then at that point it's time to start looking at the gait. So usually ask them to take, go outside with a dog and ask them to walk the dog. Sometimes, as you can see in this first video, sometimes it's relatively easy to see which leg is a painful one, because like for example in this case, this dog doesn't have a lot of hair and is behaving on the lead, is not pulling too much, is not too bad. But then if we have a look on the next video, where we have a very hairy newfie, then in this video, for example, you will, as you can see, like it's a little bit more difficult to understand which leg is the painful one. This one is actually not bad. The one leg is white, it's got white hair. The other one is dark. But again, like if a dog is pulling a little bit, if the owner is not really good at holding the dog, it might become a little bit more difficult to understand which leg is the painful one. So like a very, very easy trick would be just to use your phone. Everyone's got a smartphone nowadays. The cameras are getting better and better and better. So there is this beautiful function which is the slow motion function that you can find on the setting of your camera. And for example, like when you start using the slow motion function, you will see that it becomes very, very easy to assess which dog which leg the dog is lame on. So remember, when the head goes up, that's a painful leg, okay? Because what's happening is that the dog is trying to unload all the weight because he's putting weight on a painful leg, so he's moving the head up, and then once the head goes down, that's usually the sound leg, the normal leg. So in the next video now, you will see that it becomes a little bit easier with this big hairy newfie to understand if he's lame or not in one leg. By the way, these two are dogs that had surgery a long time ago, so I would say that they are pretty much sound at this stage, so don't worry if you're not able to recognize to see any lameness on these videos. The idea is just only that, like a slow motion video, they really do help you a lot in seeing when the head goes up, and therefore which leg is the painful leg. So yes, I would encourage you to use these simple and cheap function. Okay, so next step. Let's start with our orthopedic examination. Try to be methodical if you can. So we need to try to assess all the joints. I remember when I was at that school, I always thought that orthopedics was something very, very difficult, something that I would never be able to understand anything about it. But then in reality, is something relatively easy. It's just it's like a game. You need to find where the dog is painful. So in order to find where the dog is painful, you need to start probing every single bit, every single joint of the dog. And then once you manage to get like a painful response, then at that point you will be able to to go to the next step and start investigating this problem a little bit more. So let's start methodically. Usually I prefer to start always from the digits and from the pads, so start moving every single digit of the paw, every single joint. Usually you try to feel for something that is abnormal, so for a thicker joint, for a joint that is cracking, for a joint that is swollen. So as you can see, like what I'm doing now is that I'm checking every single digit to see if there is any reduction in range of motion. Sometimes you can have, for example, like some bad osteoarthritis affecting the digits, and so in that case you can feel it, you can palpate that the range of motion is reduced and that the dog is painful. The other thing to assess is you need to check the pads, because sometimes they can have like a foreign body, or sometimes they can have a corn in the pads, and so it's always like it's very important to check these the pads as well. Usually, remember, if a problem is related to the pads, the owner will probably tell you that the dog is worse when he's walking on gravel, on stones, and instead is absolutely fine when he's walking on grass. And so that's kind of something that we suggest you that the problem is localized to the pads. Right, let's move up. Carpus. So again, usually what we check is that we check for thickening of the joint. As you can see, I'm palpating the joint to try to see if it feels swollen, if it feels thicker than usual. And then at the point, I try to see if there is some reduced range of motion in flexion. Sometimes dogs, they can have like a restricted range of motion in flexion. I'm not really sure what the cause always is, but then sometimes they can be very painful when you check the carpus in flexion. And then the other thing that you check is if there is any sort of instability mediolaterally that would suggest that maybe some of the ligaments are ruptured, or maybe torn, or maybe they are stretched. And that's it. So at this point, once we checked all these things, then we're going to move up. Remember that you just need to trust your senses. So like, get used to touch as many dogs as you can, examine as many dogs as you can, and then at some point, at that point, once you're gonna be faced to a joint that is abnormal, you're gonna be able to recognize it immediately, and then you're gonna be able to pinpoint which one is the painful joint. Now let's move to the examination of a shoulder joint. We're gonna leave the elbow as the last one. The shoulder joint, I have several times, I have vets referring cases for shoulder problems, because when they extend and flex the joint, as I was doing a few seconds ago, they get a painful response. But then the vast majority of the time, when you flex and extend the elbow joint, pretty much what you do is that you, at the same time, you extend the elbow joint. So sometimes the pain is coming from the elbow, but like if people in general, vets in general, they think that the problem is coming from the shoulder. So when you examine the shoulder joint, try to be sure that you are not manipulating the elbow joint at the same time. So on this case, as you can see, like I'm examining if there is any reduction in range of motion, in flexion, extension. Usually there might be a painful response. And then what I'm doing right now is that I'm pressing on the craniomedial aspect of the joint within the groove where the biceps runs through to see if there is painful, because sometimes there can be, if you have a problem such as bicipital tenosynovitis, it could be very painful when you press in that region. And now what I'm doing now is the bicep test. So you try to extend the elbow joint, but in a normal dog you should not be able to fully extend this joint, because the biceps get stretched and then like it's going to stop you from fully extend the elbow joint. If you are able to fully extend the elbow joint, it might be that the biceps is partially torn. So in that case, what I would suggest is do the same with the other leg. Sometimes, don't ask me why, dogs, they can have they are able to fully extend the elbows in both sides, so they are symmetrical, and then we just only tell you that's probably normal for that dog, especially if you don't get any painful response. And when I'm doing this bicep test, I'm also trying to squeeze on the craniomedial aspect of a joint, of a shoulder joint, where the biceps runs through, because again, like if you put some focal pressure on that region when you're doing the bicep test, usually you would the dog, if the problem is localized there, the dog usually will give you a painful response. And now, after examining these other joints, let's move to the elbow joint, which is the one that we are interested in today. So, elbow joint, usually when I'm moving from the carpus up to the elbow joint, usually I try to press on the long bones, radius and ulna, because sometimes, especially in young dogs, if you have something like a panosteitis, for example, that could give you a painful response. So just get used in touching this dog as much as you can in order to get as many information as you can. And then we move up to the elbow joint. What I'm doing here is that I'm palpating the lateral aspect of the elbow joint, because sometimes you can feel that there is some degree of effusion. It feels like a puffiness on the lateral aspect of the elbow joint. And then at that point, what I do is that I start I start flexing, extending the elbow joint. So this one is a normal dog. So like if I fully extend the joint, as I'm doing here, or I fully flex the joint, he shouldn't mind. So like he's not gonna complain, he's not gonna squeak. As you can see, like I'm fully flexing the joint now and there is no problem whatsoever. In the next videos, I will show you how they do react, how they do respond if the joint is painful. What I'm doing now is I'm checking for biceps pain, because sometimes they can have a very painful biceps. So when you press on the distal third of a biceps, like in this case, this dog is not really, really happy when I'm doing that. But sometimes I found that dogs, they can be very, very, very painful when you press on the biceps. Usually those are dogs that had previous surgeries or maybe have problems with the back legs, and then they tend to unload the back legs and put all the weight on the front legs, and that's I don't really know why. I'm working on it. It seems to cause like a spasm of a biceps tendon. In the next video, you will see that another test that you can, something else that you can check. On this case, this dog is asleep, but ideally, if you do it awake, when the dog is awake, it's probably better. Again, here checking flexion extension, then now we're checking the supination. Usually, when you do this movement here, okay, which is the supination of the elbow, what you do is that you squeeze, pretty much you make the medial compartment of the elbow to collapse, and so you make the humerus, the medial humeral condyle, to press against the medial coronoid process, and then usually if you have like a problem related to the medial coronoid process, that would cause a lot of pain. Okay, so that's it. That's our orthopedic examination in a normal dog, and now we move to a dog that is instead is very painful. As you can see, like you will see now that as soon as when I'm flexing the elbow, as I said, most dogs with coronoid disease, they're not painful when you extend the elbow, but they show you that there is a problem when you flex the elbow. So for example, in this case, let's go back, in this case you will see that this dog is not showing pain when I'm extending the elbow, okay, as you can see, but then you will see that as soon as I start flexing the elbow, you can see that the old dog moves away from me. He's literally asking me, please don't flex this elbow, it's painful, I don't want to do that. Instead, if we go back to the previous slide where I was checking the flexion of a black Labrador. Let's try to load this video. Video 8. Okay, perfect. There we go. So now you will see that when I'm extension, no problem. Flexion, no problem. Can you see the dog is not moving away from me? So that's the main difference. So in a dog that is not painful, the dog will not move away from you when you flex his elbow. Okay, let's go back. Let's go to video 11 now. Next, you will see in the next video is actually even more obvious that this dog is painful. So I'm flexing, I'm extending. In this case, the dog is not totally sure about this. But then look now when I'm flexing the elbow. Literally, the dog is literally moving away from me. It's really painful. That usually tells you this elbow is painful. Okay, so that's a very good test to check if this dog is has a painful elbow or not. And then, for example, in this next video, again, exactly the same thing. So you will see that I'm just only simply like, you see, I'm just holding the carpus, I'm just starting flexing the elbow, and then you will see that the dog start moving back, sitting up like a meerkat, in a meerkat position. And again, remember, a dog that is not painful, it should not do that. Can you see on this leg, for example, like is still not happy. In fact, this dog had like a bilateral coronoid disease. So So yes, it's really important. It's a very, very good tip to take home with you today. So try to flex the elbow and see if there is any if the dog responds moving away from you. Of course, sometimes you can find some incredibly stoic dogs, but they don't flinch. It doesn't matter what you do. But then, in the vast majority of the cases, a dog will respond to pain by trying to unload the joint, by stopping you from flexing his elbow. And again, like, remember the meerkat position that will help you in the future. Okay, so the next step would be, let's have a good feel at these dog front legs. So usually I like to start by checking the muscle tone. So with your two hands, put them around the two thoracic limbs, and start from the shoulders, from the, where the scapula are, and then try to check if there is any muscle wastage, and then move down until you reach the elbows. Sometimes, like on this case, the joint effusion is really, really obvious. You can see it, like, it's puffy. It's really, really puffy. You can see it on this case. This one, there were two different dogs. You can see one had it lateral and the other one had it medial. And that's simply because if you have elbow dysplasia, that joint is probably going to be very, very inflamed and very swollen. So if the swelling is important, like in this case, you should be able to palpate it. Usually just only puffy, so something soft on the, just in the space between the anconial process and the humeral condyle on the lateral aspect, or between the anconial process and the radial head and the humeral condyle on the medial aspect. Right, let's start talking about this elbow dysplasia syndrome. So elbow dysplasia is, as you said, a syndrome. So it's just only a broad term that we use to describe some very particular diseases, so a very particular condition. This condition usually they lead to degenerative joint disease, so to arthritis. And I think it was in 1993 that the International Elbow Working Group agreed that elbow arthrosis caused by fragmented coronary process, by osteochondrosis, by uninited anconial process, and or joint incongruity, is the manifestation of inherited canine elbow dysplasia. And this elbow dysplasia is an inherited condition, so it's a genetic condition that affects mainly in large breed dogs, like Labrador Retrievers, Rottweiler, and Newfie. But that sometimes you can also see it in smaller dogs. So don't exclude it a priori if you see like a Cocker Poo. Or I remember like once I've done arthroscopy in a dog that was, I think it was a Papillon, it was like 6 kilos, it was a tiny little dog with a fragmented coronary process. So again, if you get pain coming from the elbow and your imaging either x-rays or CT scan will tell you that there is something there, it might be that that this dog, even if it's a small dog, has elbow dysplasia. So we're gonna talk quite briefly about uninited anconial process and osteochondritis dissecans, and then we're gonna talk a lot about fragmented coronary process and incongruency. So let's start with this uninited anconial process. So usually the breeds that are affected are large to giant dogs, like Bernese Mountain Dogs, German Shepherd Dogs, Golden Retriever, Labradors, Mastiff, Newfies, Rottweilers, and St. Bernard Dogs. On average, the uninited anconial process disease is bilateral in something between 20 and 35% of the dogs, and usually male dogs are affected twice as frequently as female dogs. These dogs usually they are quite young dogs, so usually they present between 5 and 12 months of age. However, sometimes, especially if the disease is bilateral, owners they might not notice that there is a problem, that there is limping, and therefore they can present to you like several years later. And sometimes they never even realize it, and then you just see it on the x-ray simply by coincidence, because you were taking x-rays for something else, and boom, you see that there is this problem. The anionatal corneal process, the anconeal process is an incredibly important structure within the elbow joint because it articulates the humerus by engaging the supratrochlear foramen from the olecranon fossa. So it provides a lot of stability to the elbow joint by limiting mediolateral movement when it's engaged into the humerus. Why is it affecting only large breed dogs? Quite simple. The anconeal process in small breed dogs does not have a separate center of ossification. And instead, in large breed dogs, like German Shepherds, for example, the anconeal process develops as a single separate center of ossification. So that's simply why large dogs have it and small dogs don't have it. There was a study where they examined the radiographic appearance of canine and elbows, and they found that like this fusion happens in greyhounds between 14 and 15 weeks of age. Instead, like in German Shepherds, it happens later. It usually happens between 16 to 20 weeks of age. What's the best way to treat them? So usually, it entirely depends by at what time these dogs present to you. It's entirely dependent by that. If they come within the first 20, 25 weeks, 26, you can still try to reattach the fragment, as you can see on these x-rays. If they come later on in life, usually it is very, very unlikely you will be able to reattach them. So both, let's step back. How do we diagnose it? Simple x-rays or CT scan, they will show you very, very well what's going on. You can see it on the, on these pictures. You can see, on the x-rays, you can see there that there is a radiolucent black line across the anconeal process. And then the other things that you can notice on these x-rays is that there is a lot of subtrochlear sclerosis. So can you see this white bone here? Okay, so that's subtrochlear sclerosis. Usually what happens is that the joint fluid is somehow upsetting the subchondral bone, and so in response the subchondral bone becomes very, very hard, and usually if it's hard on the x-rays it will show as a white bone. So usually when you take x-rays and you see this black line, this radiolucent black line, and you see a lot of white in this region, usually means that there is a problem. If we do a CT scan, it's even more obvious what the problem is. You can see this black, massive black line. So usually what I like to tell when clients ask me, what shall we do? Then here you can see on these x-rays, again, you can see the black line across the anconeal process, and you can see this intense sclerosis of the diaphysis of the ulna. And instead here you can see, again, this black line. This one is the sclerosis. Here on this elbow, sclerosis is even more evident, and then you can see usually a lot of osteoarthritic changes. We will talk about these osteoarthritic changes a little bit later on. Usually, what a Talveoner is. Right, let's what we can do is that we have a look at the fragment. Like in this case, for example, Apollo was 24 weeks old, so in theory was a little bit too old to have this process and kind of process reattached. But the idea is that what you do is that you go inside the joint, you have a look to see if a fragment is actually detached, completely detached or not from the rest of the diaphysis of the ulna. If it's not, you can try to reattach it. If it's completely detached, there is no point in trying to reattach it because it won't fuse. You will have too much fibrotic tissue in the space to allow healing of the bone. So again, like this Apollo, when I went in, I've done arthroscopy and I tried to poke, tried to push the fragment. It was not moving, so the cartilage actually looked like if it was somehow intact. So again, like what you see on the X-rays, that not necessarily means that is exactly what is going on inside the elbow. So in this case, for example, I decided to, because the cartilage was intact and the fragment was not completely detached, I decided to go to try to repair it. So like I placed like a lug screw across the ulnar diaphysis and the tiny little fragment, and then I placed also like an anti-rotational pin just to provide some extra stability. At the same time, what I've done was I've done a PU, or a proximal ulnar osteotomy. Why is that? It's simply because, like, if let's say this ulna is a little bit too short, it means that the humeral condyle is going to be pushing all the time against my poor tiny little fragment, and so it's not going to allow correct healing at where the fracture is. So the idea is that if I cut this bone here, as you can see, actually there is already, like on this extra little step, so the proximal fragment has already gone up, but just only a few millimeters. But sometimes it's just only those few millimeters that they're gonna save your repair. And so pretty much you release any sort of tension on the tiny little fragment, and so you give the fragment a chance to heal. And actually, as you can see here, 6 weeks later, the bone is already healing very, very well, and our osteotomy as well is healing very, very well. Sometimes instead, like if the fragment is completely detached, just remove it and that's it. There is unfortunately there is nothing else that you can do. In regards to the outcome, you will see that most of the dogs, actually there was a study, a retrospective study about it, and they showed that 90% of owners of dogs that had like a removal, a surgical removal of this uniting cranial process, they were satisfied with their dog's level of activity, and they rated the outcome as good to excellent. Unfortunately, only 50% of his dogs were free of lameness. So most of the time, yes, the owner is happy, the dog looks better and is happier, but then the dog is still lame. So I remember one of the last cases that I've done where I removed the fragment. The owner was very happy with the way the dog was walking, and they reported no limping when the dog was walking, but then they would report that the dog was lame when it was running. But again, if you think like the anconial process does help stabilizing the elbow joint, so if a dog starts running, you have like this joint that is all over the place and is all unstable, is all moving. So I'm not surprised that the dog is gonna be lame, if especially when running. So in this case, probably what I always tell the owner is, on the short term, the dog should do great. It's going to be less painful because there is no like a loose fragment inside the joint. But then osteoarthritis will progress, because osteoarthritis is just the consequence of more instability inside the joint and therefore more inflammation. So on the long term, I would say probably the prognosis is not incredibly good if you remove a fragment. Instead, like if you manage to reattach the fragment, like on this in Apollo's case, the prognosis should be very, very good. Okay, let's skip to the next one. Let's talk a little bit about osteochondrosis. So osteochondrosis is a term usually that is used to indicate a common developmental condition of growth cartilages, usually in skeletally immature dogs. And is a condition that's seen in many animal species and also in human beings. No one is really sure what the origin it is, what origin it has, but it's believed to be multifactorial, and usually it's got something to do with it's got an hereditary component. Is more obvious in dogs that have rapid growth, or dogs that fat dogs, so overweight dogs, and sometimes even it can be caused by trauma. And usually, it has been suggested that the primary lesion is a focal necrosis of the epiphyseal cartilage canals, which results in areas of cartilage ischemia and necrosis, which prevents intermembranous ossification. And usually, when the cartilage that is overlying this area of focal necrosis, when this cartilage fissures, then at that point you can start calling it osteochondrosis dissecans. Not before then. So pretty much OCD only when the cartilage has a fissure and starts coming off the bone, as you can see on this little picture here, like where on the where is the pointer? Oh, there we go. Okay, so as you can see, like when the cartilage, the flap, comes off the bone, that's when you can start calling it OCD, osteochondritis dissecans. Usually, as we said, it affects young dogs, large breeds, and usually affects mainly humeral head, medial humeral condyle, lateral or medial femoral condyle, and the trochlear ridge of the talus. On the CT scan, it's super easy to spot. Usually, it appears as a black radiolucent area, like a hole, pretty much, on the medial condyle. You can see this one on the craniocaudal image, and this one on the sagittal image. You can see the big hole. And again, as we were talking earlier on about, when I was talking about an uniting corneal process, if you look at the bone around this lesion, you can see that it's white, okay? And you can see that it's white there. Again, that's sclerosis, and that's because the joint fluid goes in contact with a subchondral bone, with a naked bone. The bone is not happy, and then it responds by becoming harder than usual. On this case, this dog also had like a problem with his medial coronoid process. Of course, on the X-rays, it would be looking. You can see it on the X-rays as well. So if you just take X-rays, you should be able to see still this black area at level of a medial of articular surface of a medial humeral condyle. Surgical management. There is a traditional technique and there is a newer technique. And the traditional technique consists in trying to debride, so remove the cartilage flap first of all, and then start cleaning up the hole a little bit by removing the loose and soft cartilage. And then at the point, what you would do would be osteostixis, which means pretty much try to make some little holes into the subchondral bone in order to allow bleeding. So as you can see here, so this one is a human knee, but then you can see like this one is your instrument that you use to make like a crack, literally. It's like if you were closing some microfractures within the bone. These microfractures would allow blood supply to the area, to the defect, and this blood supply will bring in good stuff that would allow fibrocartilage in filling. Usually, this fibrocartilage in filling is just pretty much just scar tissue that is going to cover with a thin layer of scar tissue, is going to cover the subchondral bone, but it's not going to be able to fill up completely the big hole left by this lesion. So that's why people, they came up with different ideas. So this one is it's called osteoallograft transplant system. What you do is that you take a core of subchondral bone and cartilage. Okay, so this one is the subchondral bone, and then you can see the cartilage on the top. And what you do is pretty much you take like the cartilage somewhere else, and then like in this case, you take it from the knee, and then what you do, you take it to the elbow. And you use it to fill to plug the hole. The only problem related to this, that's something that we do in human medicine, and it was quite common. The only problem with this technique is, first of all, you're going to end up with some donor site morbidity. So the knee is not going to be extremely happy after you remove a big bunch of bone and cartilage from it. Then the second problem is that like this cartilage here is not as good and as thick as the cartilage of the elbow. So cartilage, because the articular surface, because it is under a different load, different stress, like the cartilage thickness is different. And so like probably these plugs that you can see here, the thickness of the cartilage is not going to be as good as the one that was there previously. So again, like this technique is not used so much anymore, and instead, like we moved, people moved to a synthetic cartilage plug. This one is produced by Arthrex. You got some polyurethane at the top, some pretty much plastic at the top, and then the idea is that this substance is not going to deform, it's going to be of the right thickness, and it's going to reconstruct immediately the articular surface. So this one is what reconstructs the articular surface. This one goes inside the bone. This one is a metallic scaffold. And then the idea that the bone, a new bone, is going to grow inside this metallic mesh, and it's going to help keeping the is going to help. Sorry, I'm not sure what happened. And it's going to help keeping the plug in place. So it's pretty much, it's like if you were plugging a hole in the bone by using like this special implant. That's what I do here at the moment. I think it works beautifully. It's a easy surgery and gives amazing results. So, for example, like a quick case here for you. So this one was Lola, 8-month-old mastiff that when it presented, it was 3 out of 10 lame on the left forelimb. And again, as we said earlier, you can see here your black hole. You can see that there is sclerosis of the surrounding subchondral bone. Again, sclerosis and the black hole. So it was a relatively easy diagnosis to reach. That was the surgery. So pretty much what you do is that you place a pin right in the middle of your lesion, and then this pin is going to work as a guide for your drill. This drill is a cannulated drill, so it means that it's got a hole inside it. So you just slide the drill on the top of your pin, and then boom, you're going to be right in the perfect place. This drill has like 8 millimeter depth, so is a standard. Makes a standard hole inside the humeral condyle in this case. And then once you made your hole, then at a point you just need to put your plug in, metallic bit first and plastic bit second, and then that's it. That's how it looks. So you pretty much you reconstruct completely the topography of articular surface. These are how the X-rays look after surgery. So that's how the plug looks like on the craniocaudal view. So you can actually see, of course, only the metallic bit, and that's how it looks on the lateral view. As you can see, in this case, I've done also like a PUO, because when we were trying the previous version of a SynaCart, we noticed that sometimes if you have some sort of incongruency between humerus and ulna there, potentially this could lead to damage of a plug. So the idea is that by doing a PUO, you're going to allow this proximal fragment to move up a little bit and to open up the gap between humerus and ulna. And so by doing that, you pretty much protect the graft from abrasion or from damage. Another case, Benson, 8-month-old Newfie. Again, here you can see a massive defect in the medial humeral condyle, much bigger than what Lola had, and then this one on the on the sagittal view. Benson had a problem in both elbows, so we ended up doing surgery on one leg first, and then I think it was 2 months later we did surgery on the second leg. These are the X-rays after surgery. So again, you can see the plug. You can see the PUO. And what you can see here, apart from the plug, is a screw, because sometimes in order to access the elbow joint, you need to do an epicondylectomy, because sometimes otherwise you don't have enough space to slide your implants in. So what you can do is that you can remove the medial epicondyle, you do your surgery, and then you put back the epicondyle by using like a screw and washer, like in this case. So you can see the screw and the washer, and then you can see there the metallic bit of a SynaCart. 6 weeks later, you can see implants still in the same position and a massive amount of newborn formation on the level of the PUO. 4.5 months later, the PUO is remodeling, and 2 years later, pretty much, you can barely see that this dog had surgery. I was very happy with Benson, and then here you can see a video of happy Benson 2.5 years later, running in the fields, chasing balls. So I would consider this as a success. By the way, Benson is the dog that you saw like in the first video, in the slow motion video, which video was taken 2.5 years later. So Benson is happy and running in this field and enjoying life. Now, let's go to the probably to the most famous and most important bit, a disease that composes the elbow dysplasia syndrome. So, a little bit of anatomy. I'm sure that most of you know everything about it, but what you can see in red, that's the coronoid, the medial coronoid process. Okay, you can see it here, and then you can see it here, and then you can see it on the side. There is also a lateral coronoid process, which is a tiny little bit there on the lateral aspect, but that one never gets damaged, never causes any problem. This one is the bad boy, the one in red. You can see here I highlighted the shape of the radial head, and then here I highlighted the shape of the humeral condyle, because these are the most common manifestation of disease. So sometimes you have a problem between the radial head and the coronoid process, and sometimes instead the problem is caused by the medial humeral condyle that is rubbing against the coronoid process. I like when I'm speaking to clients, when I'm telling clients about this medial coronoid process, they always struggle to follow these words. So I'm always using, I always telling them, look, let's call this medial coronoid process, let's call it Bob. is going to be much easier for you to remember. And everyone from then on remembers about Bob. So then you can tell him Bob has a problem because Bob does not fit well with the bone that is next to him, or Bob does not fit well with the bone that is on top of him. And so usually that's quite an easy and funny way to help the owners understanding what you're actually talking about. Otherwise, if you fill their heads with a lot of difficult words, then they just lose you, and they're not just able to follow you anymore. So, first video. This one, all videos that my mentor and friend, Professor Fitzpatrick, gave me quite a while ago. They're brilliant videos. They do help showing different case scenarios, so different reasons for this coronoid process disease. So sometimes the problem, as I was telling you earlier on, is that there is incongruency between the radial head and the coronoid process and Bob. So as you can see on this video, you can see that the radial head is kind of like it's moving around. It does not fit properly and is pushing against Bob, and then he ends up being the coronoid process, and he can end up causing a problem, causing like a fragmentation of a coronoid process. So usually that's why you call it radio ulnar incongruency. Okay, and then you can see on this image, you can see the fragment. Next slide, something different, like for example, if the radius instead is short, okay, let's suppose that the radius is short, all the weight of the medial humeral condyle ends up on the poor Bob, on the poor coronary process, boom, 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 eventually it would cause like a fracture of the tip of the coronary process. Usually this one is a situation that it mainly affects older dogs, and usually it's kind of like relatively more traumatic. So usually the owner will tell you, my dog was running, it jumped, and then it suddenly went lame. And usually that's because the weight of the humerus on the poor coronoid, boom, causes like the crash of the tip of the coronoid process. And then, lastly, do you remember when I was highlighting the shape of the medial humeral condyle and of the coronoid? If there is some sort of incongruency where the medial humeral condyle does not fit properly with the coronoid process, you will end up with cartilage damage of both the coronoid process and of the coronary process and of the medial humeral condyle. As you can see here, that's medial humeral condyle. On this case, like this dog had an SEO in this video, like that I will tell you about later. But then, yes, the idea is that the main thing is that I want you to take home messages. Humeral condyle does not fit properly with coronary process, and there is profound incongruency. So the two bones are rubbing badly against each other, and then you end up with cartilage damage. Okay, so we are in general practice. We want to try to investigate the problem further. So I saw my dog. I decided that this dog is lame on the right leg. I localized the pain to the elbow. Fantastic. What shall I do next? X-rays. So X-rays, usually I do recommend taking X-rays because it does help us in then be able to tell the owner, to prepare the owner to what to expect from a CT scan and from arthroscopy, for example. So usually I do recommend taking three different X-rays per elbow. So on this case, one mediolateral with elbow extended, one mediolateral with elbow flexed, and one craniocaudal view of the elbow. So what we're going to look at is that we're going to have a look at the cranial aspect of the radial head. So you need always to focus your attention on these three or four things that now I will tell you about. So remember, first of all, Cranial aspect of a radial head, so you will be looking for some sort of newborn formation there. Okay. Then next, you try to follow the cranial margin of a medial humeral condyle. Okay. Usually you are able to see that it should be like a nice, well-defined line that starts here and then it goes up there. So in a normal elbow, that's what you should be able to do. You should be able to follow this line. Okay. Next, we look at the dorsal aspect of the anconeal process. Okay. Up there. So again, these contours should be like nice and smooth without newborn formation. Next, we look for the subtrochial sclerosis that I was telling you earlier on. So if there is a problem, you will see that this area is really, really, really white. Sometimes the white can extend further down in this direction or can extend further up. But again, that's a good indicator of that is going to tell you if there is a problem or if there is not a problem. Next step, we check this area here. Just only to be able to exclude that we have, for example, an incomplete ossification of a medial humeral condyle. Sometimes, well, if there is a problem, you should be able to see an obvious black line there where the dotted line is. And lastly, we check for the medial humeral condyle to check if there is any signs of OCD lesions, so like a big black hole and some white bone on the top. So if you remember to look at these points every time you look at some X-rays, this will help you an awful lot in be able to tell to say yes, there is a problem with this elbow. No, there is not a problem with this elbow. So, for example, like a case, a diseased elbow, as you can see here. So, again, like if we go back to have a look at the cranial aspect of a radial head, if you're looking carefully, you can see that there is some rough bone, some new bone formation there in that area. Okay, again, that will tell you, yeah, there is a problem. Next step. Not sure how well you can see it here, but then if we follow the line, the cranial edge of a coronal process, probably we can go up to there and then we lose it a tiny bit there. Most importantly, these X-rays tell us that there is an awful lot of new bone formation on the dorsal aspect of the anconeal process, as you can see there. Okay. And again, look how much subtrochial sclerosis we have. But you can see the bone is all white. Okay, I'll go back to my normal elbow so you can have a quick look at the difference. Let's see. So if you see here the level of, let's look here, the level of subtrochial sclerosis that we have there in a normal elbow and this one in a diseased elbow. And then if you go on the cranial caudal views, you can see there is a lot of rough bone on the side of a medial humeral condyle and that level of a coronoid process. So the take home message from this slide is don't just blame arthritis. I have a lot of clients that tell me, oh yeah, my dog has got arthritis, the vet diagnosed arthritis 5 or 6 years ago. And I'm thinking, well, we could have done something 5, 6 years ago, and maybe your dog now would be better. So again, like remember, if there is arthritis, there is a reason for that. Especially elbow, hip, and knee joint, and probably the hock as well. If you see arthritis, ask yourself why. If there is arthritis because there is a problem, it's not like the arthritis the human can develop without a reason, and then there is no much else that you can do about it. For elbow, hip, knee, and hock, we can always come up with something to try to make this dog feel better. Don't just blame arthritis and give this dog anti-inflammatories for the rest of his life. There is actually something that can be done to try to help with the problem. Remember, usually you have a problem, like in this case it was like incongruency between humerus and coronoid that caused an awful lot of inflammation, that caused an awful lot of arthritis. So if we could have treated like this dog like many years ago, potentially now we would have much less arthritis and the dog would be much less painful. So again, try always to ask yourself, why do you have arthritis? There are some joints, like the metacarpophalangeal joint or metatarsophalangeal joints. Sometimes the carpal joint and sometimes the shoulder joint, where you can have a little bit of arthritis without an obvious reason in old dogs. So on those joints, yeah. As in that case, you can just only blame arthritis and just only say, right, that's okay, anti-inflammatories and unfortunately joint supplements, and unfortunately there is not an awful lot we can do about it. But for the other joints, as I said, like elbow, hip, knee and hock, there is always something that we can do to try to prevent the problem from becoming much worse. Here we got Harvey. Later on I will show you the arthroscopy of this dog. So let's try to have a little exercise. Let's try to see what's wrong with this joint. Have a quick look and see if you can see something abnormal. Okay, so let's start. So let's have a look in front of the radial head. Can you see any newborn formation? Probably not. It looks relatively smooth to me. I don't see any obvious newborn formation. I don't have like a flexed view to show you, but then if we have a look at the dorsal aspect of inconel process, I don't see any obvious newborn formation, not at least like as bad as we could see on this slide there. What else? Let's have a look at the cranial margin of a coronoid process. We go probably up to there and then we lose it. So maybe that might be an indication of a problem. And then, most importantly, look at this. Can you see? Like the massive amount of subtrochlear sclerosis that we have on this case. Okay. Now, if I look at the craniocaudal, I don't see anything major, so I don't see any obvious newborn formation at this level. I don't see any obvious hole in the medial humeral condyle. I don't see any obvious fissure. On this view, it's probably difficult to assess it. You need more of an oblique view in order to be able to assess for an incomplete ossification of a humeral condyle. I think so. That's just a training exercise. We will see later on. We'll show you the arthroscopy of this dog, just to show you how simple signs like subtrochlear sclerosis in this case are important, and you don't have to underestimate them, because they can really help you in understanding that there is a problem with that joint and then something else needs doing. So as I said, check the inconel process, check the in front of the radial head, and let's check for subtrochlear sclerosis. Okay. Now, next step. So once we have some x-rays, and then we know that we have a suspicion that there is something wrong, because I can see that there is some rough bone, I can see that there is some osteoarthritic changes. Next step is that you can tell the owner, like, look, we need to do a CT scan, because unfortunately x-rays is just only a two-dimensional examination. Instead, we need a three-dimensional examination. CT scan is perfect, like, to show you if there is a problem related to the bone. It is perfect to show you if there is a fissure, if there is a fragment, these kind of problems. Remember, CT scan does not show you anything about the status of the cartilage. The cartilage is made out of water, so it's mainly out of water. So you will not be able to assess the degree of cartilage damage by simply doing a CT scan. Okay, so it's really, really important to know this thing to remind the owners about these little details, because otherwise they're going to ask you, so why can you not tell me what's going on inside the elbow? Why do I need to do an arthroscopy? I don't see the point. A CT scan should tell you exactly what's going on. Remember, CT scan unfortunately does not tell you much about the cartilage status. So, for example, on this still image, you can see an obvious black line going across our friend Bob. Okay. On this image, again, you can see a black line going across our friend Bob. And then on the sagittal view, more than obvious, like you can see a massive fragment, completely detached fragment. So like a CT scan is amazing from this point of view to tell you, to show you what exactly the problem is. Sometimes, like in this case, you don't have like an obvious black line, an obvious fissure or an obvious fracture line, but sometimes what's happening is that the tip of a coronary process is just dark, is hypoattenuated. So that again is tells you that the coronary process is diseased. Bob is not happy, Bob is diseased. And usually if it's dark, it means that Bob is, that the subchondral bone is very weak, is very fragile. Eventually it will become fragmented. So eventually you will be able to see, if you repeat the CT scan in few months time, it's very likely that you're going to see that the process has got worse. Again, like on this view, I just wanted to show you like how a normal coronary process should look like. As you can see here on the left, so it should be kind of like nice and smooth, no spurs of rough bone. It should be of the same color, usually white, and so it should not be black, or it should not have some black lines going across the medial coronoid process. Do you remember when I was telling you about CT scan is not able to assess the degree of cartilage damage? It is not able to assess it, but it can give you an indication that there is something not good going on inside the joint, because, for example, if you look at this CT scan of this elbow, yeah, okay, there is like a fragment there because you can see the black line there, but can you see how narrow the space is? Okay, so like a very narrow space, usually suggestive of a collapse of the medial compartment, and therefore you can automatically think, you know automatically that it's very, very, very likely that that the cartilage is probably going to be damaged, and when you go inside, you're going to find a bad, bad problem going on. More CT scan images of how an osteoarthritic elbow looks like. This poor dog, as you can see, like massive, like osteoarthritic changes affecting both elbows, level of the coronary, the level of the radial head, and as you can see, there, level of the medial and lateral humeral condyle. Okay, so next step, arthroscopy is my favorite. It's like pretty much like playing with an Xbox, so it's very nice. So when I describing like how a normal joint look like to the clients, I like to tell them, look, just think like if you are coming, you're entering like a room, and this room is all white. Everything should be white. The ceiling, the floor, the walls, everything should be white. And that's how a normal joint should look like. So for example, on this picture, you can see nice, uniform and smooth cartilage. That's how the coronoid process should look like. So again, this one is our coronoid process, and then here on the side, this one is the radial head that you can see just there on the side. So let's see how is this process working. Do you remember when I was telling you that the radial head and Bob do not fit properly together? That's what happens. So the radial head starts pushing against the poor medial coronary process. It's like if it was like a massive earthquake going across the poor coronary process, and then you can end up with an obvious fragment, or sometimes just a fissuration. situation. What's important to remember is that even if you don't see an obvious fragment of fissuration, you need to know that the subchondral bone underneath the cartilage is damaged, is diseased, is weak. So it's going to be painful, and eventually it will become a fragment. So again, as I was saying, that's how a fragmented coronoid process looks like. So you can see, let me put the pointer there. Fantastic. So you can see down here, that's our fragment. Let's stop the video here a second. So you can see that's our fragment. If it is, in this case, is completely detached. This bone that you can see here on the right side, that's the radial head, and that's the medial humeral condyle. So again, radial head has been pushing against the poor coronary process. It caused this earthquake, and then eventually led to like a fragmentation of our poor coronary process. The rest of the cartilage, as you can see, is relatively good. It's all covered by white, smooth cartilage, no obvious black holes, and no obvious red holes. So it means that the rest of the cartilage is in good condition, and the main problem is caused by this coronoid process. And literally, it's like a gear that does not work. Radial head carry on pushing against the poor coronoid, and it caused this fragmentation. So, do you remember when we were talking about Harvey? So, we said that the Harvey had a lot of subtrochlear sclerosis. Okay, so that's the arthroscopy of that case. As you can see, it's relatively obvious and big fragment that we have there. So, no massive osteoarthritic changes apart from some subtrochlear sclerosis, but this is the result. Okay, so a massive, large fragmentation of the medial coronary process. So again, pay always attention to these little signs. So cranial aspect of radial head, try to check if you can follow the cranial margin of the coronary process, osteoarthritic changes on the top of the coronary process, and subtrochlear sclerosis. How a fissuration looks like? That's how it looks like. So you can see here the fissuration. Okay, you can see it like it's just only like a big a black line that goes across the coronoid. So that's not yet a completely detached fragment, but just only a fissuration. And so on this case, on the image on the left, we can say that the cartilage is in relatively good condition. On the right side, not really, because you start seeing some massive defects, some big defects of the cartilage. So I would call this like a partial thickness cartilage defect, because you start seeing the bone underneath the cartilage. So, from a surgical point of view, what we're going to do at this point, if we have like a fragmentation of fissuration, like in this case, is something called SCO, which stands for subtotal coronoid ostectomy, where pretty much like through a keyhole procedure, through arthroscopy, I managed to remove like a wedge of bone. So, by doing that, what I do is that I remove the fragment, I remove the surrounding subchondral bone that I know to be diseased, and at the same time I open up the gap between radial head and coronary process. So in this way, the radial head is not going to be able to push anymore against the poor coronary process, and it's not going to cause any further problems. That's how an arthroscopic SCO looks like. So again, this one is the dog that we saw earlier on. You can see the fragment down there. You can see me going in Let's use the point. Me going in using my little osteotome, as you can see there, and then my assistant start tapping the osteotome, and then so pretty much that's how it works. And then you can see, usually when the bone is yellowish, usually it's because a diseased bone is a weak bone. Okay, so. Again, now I've removed my wedge, and then I just need to go inside with some forceps, grab the fragment, and take it out. Let's go forward a little bit. Okay, and then the fragment is coming out completely. There is just only the last bit left in, and that's it. And that's the whole wedge that just came out. Another quick video of how the an arthroscopic SEO looks like. Again, my assistant is with a mallet is hitting the osteotome that I'm holding, and then I start going through the bone, which usually is very soft, and so it's like a cutting through cheese, pretty much. And that's it. You can actually see that there is some hemorrhage on the subchondral bone, and now away from the down there, away from where the radial head is, which again is supportive of the fact that the bone, the subchondral bone, is not happy, and that's because like the earthquake has come through the poor coronary process and caused problem and pain. Okay, so that was the first level of lesions that we can find inside the joint. So a fragment or a fissure, and but in general like a normal cartilage. Next level up is where we start having like some problems with the cartilage. And so usually you're not supposed to see the subchondral bone, as you can see in this case. So remember from the future, if you ever look at some arthroscopic images, if you see pink, pink is the subchondral bone, pink is bad. Instead, if you see like white, white is the cartilage, and white is good. So, like on these, as you can see on these images, on this slide, you can see that here at the top we have like a large lesion. So where we got a large area where the cartilage is completely missing. On the image at the bottom, you can see like literally these tracks. So do you remember when I was telling you that the medial condyle is rubbing against the coronary process? That's how it looks like, and it also reminds me of how like the grooves of a tire looks like, and that's because like there is profound incongruency between the bone at the top, the medial humeral condyle, and the bone at the bottom, the coronoid process. So if we have a look now at the video that I have here on the left side, let's see, that's how like how an incongruent elbow looks like. So here in this case we are talking about humero-ulnar incongruency, where humerus does not fit with the ulna, in this case with the coronary process. You can see that at the top we have, let's use the pointer, and then you can see that at the top we have these massive grooves within the cartilage. Then you can see that you got some pink at the top, so you can see the subchondral bone of the humeral condyle, and then you can see some the subchondral bone of the medial humeral condyle. Again, when you see these changes, these suggest that you have humero-ulnar incongruency. So that's the second level of damage that you can have in a joint. So what shall I do in the, what shall we do in this case? Well, on this case, usually the best treatment is proximal ulnar osteotomy. So the way it works is that by, you will see now, the blade that is cutting the proximal ulna, this will allow the proximal fragment to do two things. First of all, to move up, to more proximally. And so, pretty much by moving proximally, it means that the proximal fragment is also going to tilt, and so it's going to open up the gap a little bit between humerus and ulna there, where my pointer is now. By doing that, what you're doing pretty much is that you lower slightly the medial coronoid process, and by lowering the medial coronoid process, you open up the gap between medial humeral condyle and coronoid process. You, let's say, between bracket, you put the area at rest, you allow the scar tissue, fibrocartilage, to come and cover the areas of pink, and then usually once you manage to cover these areas of pink with fibrocartilage, usually at that point is when you have a joint that is not painful anymore. And so if we go back to the slide and we have a look at these x-rays, you will see on this axis, more or less, where is the cut supposed to go? Usually, you need to be around three fingers, like away from the radial head. You are more or less around one third, between one third and one and half of the length of the ulna, and by cutting the bone, the ulna there, what's gonna happen is that, as I said, like this proximal fragment is gonna move up a tiny bit, and also because it's moving up, it's also tilting. Okay, as you can see with this arrow, by tilting it, it's gonna open up the gap between medial humeral condyle and coronoid process. And by opening up the gap, we're going to stop the rubbing. The other things that we achieve by doing that's going to happen, like after you do a PUO, is that this part of the bone tends to, pretty much you have like this one, the ulna tends to kick laterally here at this level. So that's why the idea of a bi-oblique ulnar osteotomy. So that's in one plan and then that's on the other plan, okay? Because what you're going to achieve by doing an oblique cut is that like this wedge of bone here is going to stop this wedge of bone here from kicking laterally too much. I will show you later like a case study where pretty much the cut was not done properly, and you will see how badly the bone struggles to heal. So again, like on this view, this oblique cut, you're going to have this wedge of bone here of a distal fragment is going to stop the wedge of bone of a proximal fragment from kicking back too much. And then on the craniocaudal view, this wedge of fragment, this bone is going to stop the proximal bone from kicking laterally too much. The approach is really, really easy because you can palpate the ulna very, very well. So it's just only a matter of palpating where the ulna goes, and then just only do an incision and then detach all the muscles from the bone. Again, this one is the nice case study that again my friend Noel Fitzpatrick did when I was there training with him. So this one is the same dog actually, and one leg was by mistake cut with an angle that was not oblique enough. Instead, the other one it was. So as you can see here, you can see the cut there just next to the dotted line, and then you can see the other cut there next to the oblique line. And so we will see over the following weeks what happened. So Okay, so this one is more of a traditional technique. You will see the proximal fragment has kicked back quite a lot, is nearly on the verge of becoming completely displaced. There is not an awful lot of new bone formation. Instead, here we can see the bone as the proximal aspect has moved up, but then is not terribly displaced, and is actually like the two parts of the bones that are next to each other, and they are trying to heal. 4 months later, again, you can see that here the bone is still healing, this big, large callus osseous formation, whilst on the other leg is pretty much like it's already started the remodeling process. 9 months later, on the right side is pretty much perfect, on the left side is still healing. So usually it's because there is too much movement between the two parts, two ulnar segments, and so that's why the bone struggles to heal. So again, like this one was a nice case to show the advantages of a very oblique proximal ulnar osteotomy. This procedure is beautiful because it gives you some amazing results in terms of bone healing, elbow pain resolution. So usually all these dogs that they have this procedure, like 3 months later, they got no elbow pain anymore. So which is great, because that's what you want. You want to resolve the pain. But unfortunately, it's got like a very high complication rate, because as you can see, for example, in this case, this one was a fat, super fat pug, that as you can see, 6 weeks later, there was pretty much no signs of bone healing at the osteotomy site. 3 months later, nothing has happened. 4 months later, I ended up having to plate it and put some bone graft, because the bone was not healing, the dog was still lame, the dog was still painful when I was pressing on the osteotomy site, and 1 month later, the fat pug managed to break my, I think this one was a 2-0 plate. So I went in a place like a bigger plate, I went for a 2-4 plate. He managed to break the 2-4 plate as well. And so the bone at the point was somehow desperately trying to heal. So eventually I ended up having to remove the 2-4 plate and place an external fixator, place some more graft in the area. Probably the fat pack is still laughing at me at the moment, but I've heard from the owner a month ago, he's happy and running around, and he definitely does not have elbow pain anymore. This one is one of my other most recent disasters related to a PUO surgery. This one was a border collie, slightly overweight as well, but 7 years old. So 7 years old means that the bone in that area, it won't heal as well as a younger dog. 5 months later, on the 6 weeks and 12 weeks x-rays, the bone was not healing at all. Later on, I think it was 4 months later, he managed to cause a fracture of a distal fragment and he managed to break the pin. This one is 5 months later, the detached fragment is healing. The bone are close to each other, and that's how we are 8 months later. So as you can imagine, it's very frustrating both for the owners and for me, to have to deal with a case 8 months later, the bone is still healing and it has not reached full fusion. So as I said, it's a brilliant procedure, but it carries some risks. So before, when I'm doing the consultation with the owner, I'm always stressing the importance of keeping the dog properly confined after the surgery, and the possible complications that you could have following this procedure. Right, next level, level three. So where we have, level one was just only fragmentation, fissuration with normal cartilage. Level two, we have some spots of pink both on the top and the bottom. And then level three, we got a lot of pink that is affecting usually the whole medial humeral condyle. So just to give you a rough idea how we score this cartilage damage, there are 5 degrees, and then usually the worst grades are grade 4 and grade 5. Grade 4 is where pretty much you can see that it's all red, and grade 5 where the bone becomes eburnated, so it becomes orange pretty much. So for the following procedure that I'm going to tell you about, they're all cases that they have like either a grade 4 or grade 5 cartilage disease of the medial humeral condyle, medial compartment first, and then later on I will tell you a little bit more about a damage of a full compartment. So for those dogs that have a damage only of a full thickness cartilage damage of a medial humeral condyle, we do this pole technique, which is called proximal abducting ulnar osteotomy. So in a dog that has like a medial compartment disease, the medial compartment tends to collapse, and the full weight of weight bearing of a leg goes through the painful compartment. So the idea of this stepped plate is that pretty much what it's going to do is going to shift all the weight from the medial painful compartment to the lateral non-painful compartment. So pretty much you open up the gap a little bit, and then again you shift all the weight to the lateral compartment. Of course, like it is really, really important before you decide to go for this technique that the lateral compartment has to be in good condition. So when you have inside the joint with your scope, you need to see a damage of a medial compartment, but you need to check at the lateral compartment, and that has to be fine. It has to be all white and nice and smooth and thick. So the way pretty much this plate shifts the weight is because of this step. As you can see, there is a step here, okay, and so pretty much by applying laterally this plate to the ulna after doing your osteotomy, you change the weight bearing axis of the leg, and pretty much you shift all the weight from the medial to the lateral compartment. And also, like, the other thing that you achieve is that because you kick the proximal fragment caudal a little bit by doing this procedure, at the same time you lower the coronoid, and so again you open the gap between medial humeral condyle and medial coronoid process, which is pretty much what you achieve when you do a PUO, proximal ulnar osteotomy technique. So as I said, usually I do use this technique only for cases where they have an outer bridge grade 4 or 5 cartilage disease of a medial humeral condyle only. You can see very nicely here the difference between, let me stop the image, between the diseased compartment, this one is medial, okay, and the normal lateral compartment. Okay, so this one, this side has been rubbing badly against the poor coronary process. Instead, this side is still normal. So usually you check there, it's white. You check very down head, down there, and it's white. So that's a case where you can do a pole. If you have some pink, some cartilage damage affecting the lateral compartment, you cannot do a pole technique, because what you will do will be only shifting from a painful compartment to a painful compartment, which makes no sense. You're not going to achieve anything. But yes, you can see very nicely on this video the extent of cartilage damage that we have inside our medial compartment of the elbow. Okay, surgery is easy, well, relatively easy. So pretty much what you do is that you check that your plate fits in nicely first, then you cut the bone, you do an osteotomy of the ulna, and then you just apply your plate. These one are locking screws, about 4 or 5 millimeter for large dogs, so it's quite a large screw, so it's quite a strong a strong plate, strong screws. So, for example, like if you look at these x-rays, you can see like these elbows, they got tremendous arthritis. So again, in front of the cranial cranial aspect of a radial head, dorsal aspect of a coronal process, you definitely lose the definition of a coronoid process there. Some subthyroid sclerosis, this one is a dog that will definitely have some degree of cartilage damage. Sometimes by looking at these x-rays, you can already tell the owner, look, I'm not going to do any CT scan because I can already tell you that there is like a severe cartilage damage. And so let's go straight for arthroscopy. And actually, like my friend and colleague Mike Farrell, like he published like a study where he showed a correlation between the amount of osteophyte formation on the dorsal aspect of the coronal process and a certain degree of cartilage damage within the joint. So again, like if you see a case like this where there is so much arthritis, CT scan is not it's not helpful because you already know that there is already like a cartilage damage. So it's just better to go straight in, do arthroscopy, see, assess what the extent of the cartilage damage is, and then at that point decide what to do. In this case, Paul, it was what I've done. So you can see here where is the osteotomy and then the plate applied from the lateral view and from the craniocaudal view. This one is a nice case just to prove that Paul works. This dog was a 4-year-old Labrador retriever called Saul. A colleague of mine did a Paul procedure like 1 year previously. Then 1 year later, the dog came to see me for a problem with the other leg. So I've asked the owner, shall we have a look in the other leg to see, to assess exactly what's going on and to see if we need to do anything else. And you will see in this video now, you will see that what was previously all pink, all cartilage damage, has been replaced with some scar tissue, with some fiber cartilage. So can you see like the, let's put the pointer in there. Okay, so as you can see here, this one is all scar tissue, it's all new fiber cartilage covering the defect. You can actually see down here the line that there was before between normal and abnormal, and you can see that the whole medial compartment has been filled in with new fiber cartilage. Brilliant results that will make us orthopedic surgeons happy. So that's a proof that Paul can work. Unfortunately, it does not work in all the cases, because for example, this one is another case, Willow, Labrador. I've done, the dog was not getting better 8 months later, so we had a look to see what's going on. You can see some little isolate of fiber cartilage, these white patches that you got on the medial humeral condyle, which means that it was working, so it somehow like it was, at least it stopped the progression, the cartilage damage progression, but probably, I don't know if the step was not big enough, it was not causing, it was not allowing proper scar tissue fiber cartilage to come in and cover completely the pink, as it did happen with the previous case of Saul that I showed you earlier on. There is another technique that is similar to the pole, which is called sliding humeral osteotomy, invented again by my friend Noel Fitzpatrick. The idea of this technique is you try to achieve the same. So you try to shift all the weight that goes through the painful medial compartment, and you try to shift it to the other compartment, so to the lateral compartment that is fine and is healthy and is able to take the weight. In order to achieve that, what you do is that usually you cut the humerus there, you put the stepped plate, and then that's how you shift the weight. I will show you now a video of how the procedure works. There we go. So pretty much like you've done your cut of the humerus there, and then you start tightening up the screws, and then you can see the humerus start shifting, and so that's how we change the load-bearing axis of the humerus. There we go. This one is another proof this technique works as well. So This one was a Rottweiler. These images were taken 2 years after SHO. And again, here you can see brilliant, beautiful scar tissue fibrocartilage covering completely the medial medial humeral condyle. So this one was the demarcating line when this one was all damaged and this one was normal. And then you can see the scar tissue. And I hope you can appreciate like the difference between normal cartilage, nice and thick and smooth, and fibrocartilage where it's all bumpy and is not as it does not look as thick as normal cartilage. Again, this one is the same case. No, this one is a different case where you can see clearly the damage before. So you can see the old pink, remember pink is bad, white is good. So damage of the medial compartment. And then this one was 1 year later where this one has been filled in with a lot of fibrocartilage. And these dogs usually, they're dogs that they are not painful anymore when you manipulate the elbows. They do have arthritis, so it might be that the range of motion is restricted, but then they're not painful when you flex extend the elbow. So remember, like, unfortunately, there is nothing you can do about the arthritis. So maybe the dog will be still, it will look lame, but it's not a painful lameness. It's more of a mechanical lameness. So it's really important to distinguish between these two types of lameness, because a mechanical one, it means you can live with that, but instead you cannot live with a painful lameness. What about if the damage, the pink is affecting both the medial and the lateral compartment, so it's pink everywhere? What are we going to do in those cases? This one is like a case that I've done last week where there was a damage of a medial humeral condyle, there was a damage of a medial coronary process, there was a large fragment there, and most importantly, this one is the radial head that I'm moving right now. As you can see, it's pink, this radial head as well. That's not good because it means that we cannot do a pole procedure and we're going to have to do something else. Unfortunately, for those dogs that have like elbows completely damaged, like on this case, from a surgical point of view, I don't think there is nothing from a surgical point of view that is working well at this time. So total elbow replacement is an option, of course. There was this old Iowa, these Tate implants, and now more recently these Sirius implants. None of them, because like the elbow joint is such a complex joint with so many movements, you've got three bones that are trying to fit properly together, and they do so many movements that you cannot replicate this movement with any of these implants, unfortunately. It's not like a hip, when you do a hip replacement where you just have a ball and you just have a socket and it's dead easy. Like I think these total elbow replacement implants are not ready yet, so that's why at the moment I'm not really recommending them, because from what I see from colleagues of mine that have done this surgery or other referral centers, like the results that they achieved, they are not good enough for me to be able to ask the client, right, spend £6,000-£8,000, I put like a new elbow into your dog. The results are not going to be, they're not going to be so good. So kind of like I don't feel like really recommending total elbow replacements anymore. Not yet, at least, let's say so. Another option would be arthrodesis, which is not an easy surgery, but it can give you some good results in terms of getting rid of the pain. Usually these dogs are dogs that are going to end up with a mechanical lameness, but not a painful lameness, which is the most important thing. So you just get rid of all the cartilage, you place tons of plates and screws to keep everything still, and usually that's one of the possible ways of getting rid of the pain. To be honest, we don't do it very often. We probably do it maybe once or twice every year, so it's not a common procedure. What I start liking recently is this platelet-rich plasma therapy, where pretty much what you do is that you filtrate the blood of his own dog, you keep the platelets, and then you reinject the platelets inside the elbow joint. The platelets, as you know, they are rich in growth factors, so the idea is that like you're gonna inject. By injecting these platelets inside the joint, you're going to help reducing the inflammation inside the joint. So you're going to make the dog more and more comfortable. I must have done probably something between 25 and 30 cases treated with these platelets. And I must say that like probably in around 70% of the cases, there was an improvement, which means that the dog, of course, has still a reduced range of motion, there is no doubt, because these dogs, they have a lot of arthritis, but then either they were more comfortable or either the owner was able to stop all the medications such as tramadol and anti-inflammatories. So I consider that as a success. If I can get the dog off of medication, I consider it as a success. So that's something that we are doing more and more often, and I'm quite pleased with the results. What we use here is a kit that comes with everything inside. So you got the filtering set, you got all your solution, all your syringes, and is relatively easy to perform. I had like a few questions about this type of implants, this type of systems, because someone tried to check what was the exact amount of platelets that you were injecting back into the joint, and in reality the amount of platelets that you were injecting was not as high as at the one that was advertised on the back of a box. So there is always like a question mark of how efficient these kind of ready kits are, but nonetheless it did help. Going back, like when I was saying, like 70% of them they did improve, then probably another 20% it made no difference, and in another 10% actually the dog carry on getting worse. And so I would say, like in general, I think it works. I think it's a promising procedure. Another way to deal with the problem, which is something similar to the platelets, is this Artramid, which is a polyacrylamide hydrogel, which is pretty much like if you were injecting some silicone pretty much inside the joint. And the idea is that these arthritic joints usually are very dry, there is no joint fluid anymore, so you got bare bone rubbing on bare bone, and that can be quite painful. So by injecting the silicone inside the joint, usually you help lubrication, and then usually the dog feels better, and usually it works better, or at least you can try to give a dog less medications. Again, that's recently new. Here, Davies, especially, we must have done maybe between 5 and 10 dogs with these techniques. The owner seems to be happy. Unfortunately, we are not able to scientifically prove that this kind of treatment they actually work, they actually make a difference. The owners seem happy. They seem happy, but again, like that doesn't necessarily mean that the dog is actually happier. And lastly, for dogs that got like a lot of they got osteoarthritis, usually I do recommend a joint supplementation with some joint supplements that have omega-3 fatty acids inside, because glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, there are mixed results about do they work really, or is it just only a placebo? Instead, like in humans, in the human field, like they proved the omega-3 fatty acids, they do help reducing the inflammation inside the joint. So I do usually recommend a product that contains either omega-3 fatty acids or green lip muscles. And usually I ask the owner to continue it on an ongoing basis. And hydrotherapy, of course, that's really, really important during the rehabilitation process. So just only to try to keep the dog fit and to try to keep this joint moving, because the movement of the joint is really, really important. So benefits of hydrotherapy, they do include muscle strengthening, alleviating muscle spasm, increased range of motion of the joints, and relief of pain, swelling, and stiffness. So I would definitely, like in a dog that either has arthritis, has elbow dysplasia, and has been treated, I usually do recommend hydrotherapy. And in dogs that they don't decide not to go for surgery, still, I would still recommend this kind of treatment. And that's all. I hope you enjoy the presentation. I hope that it was easy to understand. If there is any question, I think there is just only one person online at the moment. So if you have any question, please feel free to ask. That's it.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alan for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.